spinning, sliding. Bend forwards, conquer backwards. Ready, steady, don't feel it. Don't feel steady, go. Don't want to go.
Thank you. How can I now be otherwise? What is now? Can I now be otherwise? Mankind today versus mankind tomorrow. Caught up by passion, we seize opportunities. Technological advances or breakdowns. New dimensions of the struggle with nature. Choice of tyranny and slavery made difficult essential conditions of freedom and happiness. Moral progress, the ethical ideal, irrelevant, irrelevant. There are things which are and should not be. There are things which are not and should be.
Three Teens Kill Four and Crime Drama from their No Motive LP, originally from 1983, that got reissued by Derek Entries back in 2017. Prior to that, Raid on Abatement, a cool band from Virginia who have a new cassette out. That song's on it. It's called E.T. Writes a Hit. We also heard some killer queer feminist UK post-punk from Siren. That song was Breaking It Down from their 1982 LP called Plays. And starting the set was Shunned and Aufstand, one of the four songs on their 1982 7-inch. Next is the Philly band Eraser. You have a new record coming out very soon on Salt Breeze. We're going to hear a track from that. This is Crindy. Thank you. some Dutch punk there from Atoms. The song was Women from the Oerwormer comp from 1982. Before that was Christmas and Wilhelm Reich from their Ballad of the Invisible Girl 7-inch from 1984. Before that, Drowning is Easy from New Zealand and a song called Lost Without a Map, which you can find on the Krypton 10 compilation. And before Drowning is Easy, we heard the November Group doing The Popular Front from their 1982 12-inch on Modern Method. And starting things off was Eraser and Crindy from their brand new record Operator. I have one more song left for y'all, but before that, a few announcements. If you'd like to listen to previous episodes of Maximum Rock and Roll Radio, you can go to maximumrockandroll.com/radio. There are dozens and dozens of them. Have at it. If you'd like to drop us a line via email, you can contact us at radio@maximumrockandroll.com. If you have any music that you would like to submit for potential airplay or to be reviewed on our website, maximumrockandroll.com, please send one copy of CD, vinyl, or cassette releases to MRR, P.O. Box 3852, Oakland, California, 94609, USA. And speaking of reviews, if you have strong opinions about punk and punk-adjacent music and you're good with deadlines and you might want to do record reviews for Maximum Rock and Roll, please drop us a line at reviews@maximumrockandroll.com for more information. And if you would like to support us financially, donations help us keep bringing you radio shows and record reviews because we are entirely volunteer-run. So you can send us donations by going to maximumrockandroll.com/donate. My name is Erica Elizabeth. The last song I have this time around is by an Australian band called Electric Fans, who put out one 7-inch back in 1980, and this is a track from that called Dying Star. Thanks so much for listening to Maximum Rock and Roll Radio.
Thank you. can I believe you won't talk? Obviously, you don't believe we won't talk. But if we said anything, we would probably be hunted down and executed. So to save our own lives, we won't talk. On the other hand, we don't much believe that you won't try to take revenge on us. After you go home, you might still worry about us and send someone to kill us to keep us quiet. Killing someone to keep them quiet requires recruiting others to do the killing, and one of us might still escape long enough to broadcast tonight's events on the internet for all the world to see. There are dangers either way. You can figure out the odds yourself. You can surely understand that, rationally, the best thing to protect our own interests is for all of us to maintain complete silence and not make any unnecessary moves or attract any unwanted attention. In other words, both sides should abide strictly by this live-or-die-together agreement. Rationally? Agreement? Exclaimed He Dongshen. You seem to have too much faith in human nature. I'm willing to take a gamble, said Ou Chen. Are you? You know the story of the frog who carried a scorpion across the river, don't you? The scorpion could not help itself from killing the frog, and then it drowned. That was its nature. True enough, true enough. Both sides are taking a risk. I have to admit that this is a dangerous gambit that we are forced to employ. If there was another way, I would not want to risk my life in such a dangerous fashion. Four lives balanced against your official position. I'd have to say that we are risking much more than you are. To tell you the truth, I suggested this plan because I couldn't think of any other strategy that would meet the demands of both sides. Brother Dongshen, can you come up with a better win-win solution? Take your time and think it over. He Dongshen thought the whole situation was preposterous. But he was not in the middle of a dream. This live-or-die-together idea was a mug's game, but Ou Chen and the others seemed to be quite serious about it. They are risking their lives to ask me a few questions and will then let me go. What on earth are these lunatics thinking? But it looks like all I have to do is agree to play the game, and I can stay alive at least temporarily. After I get out, I'll have the initiative and everything will be easier to handle. You can ask your questions, said He Dongshen, but I can't reveal any state secrets. That's not up to you, said Ou Chen. We're not here to haggle over prices like we do in Xiaoxue Street. The four of us have risked everything, and we want you to answer all our questions until we are completely satisfied. We've already put aside all considerations of death, so if we are not fully satisfied with your answers, this would all become meaningless. We're all prepared to see the jade smashed to pieces and face death together. Besides, Brother Dongshen, whether or not you give away any state secrets, if your honourable party suspects you of doing so, then you have given away state secrets. If we broadcast this scene up to this point only, I think you would never get clean, even if you jumped into the Yellow River. Live or die together is a complete, indivisible, perfectly unbreakable circle of agreement. Both sides either abide by it completely, or the deal is off. What do you say?
I have to leave at daybreak, said He Dongshen, afraid that if he stalled any longer, Ou Chen might change his mind.
It's a promise.
Give me another glass of water.
As Zheng Du gave He Dongshen another glass of water, Ou Chen took the opportunity to give instructions to Little Si and Fang Chaodi. Speaking also for He Dongshen's benefit, he said,
Whatever is asked and answered here tonight is only for the five of us to hear. None of it is ever to be leaked to the outside world, even if you think it should be. This is the key element of the live or die together agreement.
No one responded.
You all agreed already, said Ou Chen, to follow my instructions even if I told you to do something that you didn't want to do. So you'll do as I say, okay? They nodded. What are you waiting for? Asked He Dongshen. If you don't ask me something soon, it'll be daylight. Fire away.
The Chinese Leviathan. The interrogation. He Dongshen began to speak, and once he started talking, he had an irrepressible charisma.
His listeners occasionally interrupted him with a question. In the last 20 years, Chinese official discourse has hardly ever mentioned the events of 1989, as though not mentioning them would make them disappear from history. In order to avoid trouble, popular discourse also avoided discussing the entire year of 1989. Even when recalling events of the 1980s, discussions always ended with the end of 1988. So everybody joked that in China, 1988 was immediately followed by 1990. One year was not to be mentioned. Had it disappeared? For some people, that year was an indelible memory. It was just like the title of a book commemorating the 4th of June 1989 Tiananmen Massacre by the Hong Kong Journalists Association, The People Will Never Forget. But will the people really never forget? For the great majority of young mainland Chinese, the events of the Tiananmen Massacre have never entered their consciousness. They've never seen the photographs and news reports about it, and even fewer have had their family or teachers ever explain it to them. They have not forgotten it. They have never known anything about it. In theory, after a period of time has elapsed, an entire year can indeed disappear from history because no one says anything about it. According to He Dongshun, 2009 was the 90th anniversary of the 1919 May 4th movement, the 60th anniversary of the establishment of the Chinese Communist government, the 50th anniversary of the Dalai Lama's escape from China, the 20th anniversary of the 1989 Tiananmen incident, and the 10th anniversary of the suppression of the Falun Gong movement. The so-called 90, 60, 50, 20, 10 anniversaries made everybody very nervous. So people jokingly made another suggestion. From now on, after 8, we should just go straight to 10. After 2018, let's just go on to 2020. The 4th of June 1989 had little direct connection, however, to He Dongshun and his generation of Communist Party and national leaders. They'd all risen into the government's inner circles of power after 1995 and were not tainted by the original sin of 4th of June 1989. After the events of 2009 had passed, He Dongshun believed that that year had been alarming but not dangerous, certainly not as fraught with danger as 2008. A couple of years later, the external situation suddenly changed again when the world economy entered a new period of crisis that was certain to unleash long-suppressed internal contradictions. Added to that was the party state's imminent change of leadership in 2012, and that was the period when the Communist Party's mettle was most severely tested. From 2008 onwards, a whole series of incidents took place. A riot in Wan'an in Guizhou province of over 10,000 people accusing the police of covering up the death of a young girl. The July 2009 riot of over 10,000 Tonghua iron and steel workers in Jilin province against a takeover by a privately owned company. The June 2009 Xishou City riot in Hubei province due to the suspicious death of Tu Yuanguo, a chef at the Yonglong Hotel, and to widespread anger at alleged drug trafficking and official corruption. Government reported large-scale collective public security incidents of over 500 people had risen to over 100,000 a year. All these incidents made He Dongshun realize that local governments were very weak in the face of collective protest riots. In Wan'an, the government and police simply threw down their weapons and ran away. And in Tonghua, if the central government machine had gone into action, it would have had to suppress industrial workers. If the Communist Party suppressed industrial workers, what would become of its legitimacy? After these incidents, He Dongshun was assigned to a top-secret small group in the central government, tasked with drawing up contingency plans for any future large-scale disturbance. They came up with a number of proposals. At the same time, Party Central held a series of joint planning meetings with the military, the public security police, and the special armed police, a force organized in the wake of the Tiananmen incident. They also brought several thousand county-level party secretaries and leading public security bureau cadre to Beijing to undergo intensive training. In 2009, He Dongshun was already clearly aware that the world economy was going to experience another crisis even greater than the one before. If the Chinese government handled it properly, though, it might actually present just the right set of circumstances for China to find a solution to its long, unresolved internal problems and turn a danger into an opportunity. He Dongshan even believed that whether or not China could enter an era of ascendancy earlier than expected depended on only two things: the international situation and the appearance of some stroke of luck in China's internal situation that would allow the government to take full advantage of the opportunity to bring order out of chaos and complete all of the unfinished business of the last 30-plus years of reforms and openness. What he meant by a stroke of luck was, to put it frankly, a major crisis. Only a major crisis could induce the ordinary Chinese people to accept willingly a huge government dictatorship. There were two major reasons that could induce the Chinese people to accept the Chinese model of one-party rule. It would promote social stability, and it would concentrate resources to accomplish big things. That is to say, the preservation of social stability would be only a necessary condition of the party state's legitimacy. This is because democratic systems are not necessarily unable to maintain stability themselves. Take Taiwan, for example. We ridicule them for their democratic chaos, but they carried off a peaceful transition of power and their political situation remained quite stable. Thus, just saying we can maintain social stability is not enough. We have to prove that our one-party rule can accomplish big things that democratic systems are unable to accomplish. If we cannot do this, the value of maintaining our one-party rule will be open to challenge. He Dongshan was just waiting for a major stroke of luck that would allow for the accomplishment of big things. Privately, his plan was known as the Action Plan for Ruling the Nation and Pacifying the World. This title followed the old Neo-Confucian slogan, but no matter how many sleepless nights he spent thinking about it, with its echoes of Imperial Confucianism, he just couldn't come up with a new name. If a major crisis didn't occur in a timely fashion, the transition from the then ruling group to a new ruling group would be fraught with danger. On the one hand, the Communist Party's transfers of power have always been dangerous, full of fierce power struggles between various inner party factions. On the other hand, there have certainly been many problems during the past few years, starting with the 2008 financial tsunami. Contradictions in Chinese society have intensified, party officials have been shown to be at fault at every turn and have indeed grown extremely weak. They've given their enemies much food for criticism. If things continued like that right up to the next party congress, the ruling group would certainly have to step down. He Dongshan was not a member of the ruling group's inner circle. At the time, he was merely a major figure who had served consecutive party leaderships. He had a pretty good idea, though, who was slightly less reprehensible and who was much more unscrupulous. He rather preferred to support the empowerment of some of those technocrats who had little family background to recommend them. Be that as it may, he didn't want to be dragged into the storm of a power struggle between various factions. He didn't want to see China's political situation thrown into greater turmoil due to a transfer of power within the party. He needed heaven's help. If, about a year before the scheduled transfer of power, a major crisis occurred and the Politburo decided to scrupulously follow his action plan for ruling the nation and pacifying the world, with that, He Dongshan believed, China would certainly be saved. Of course, future generations would never know how much blood, sweat and tears he, He Dongshan, had contributed to the perfection of this strategy. They would never know that his plan was his own ingenious design to preserve forever Communist Party rule in China. All of the credit would go to the existing party state leadership. He Dongshan had grasped very early on the imminence of another crisis in Western capitalism. His own investment strategy was to bet against the US dollar. He'd been in Zhongnanhai for so many years, and at first, like all the other high officials, he spent as much as possible of his Chinese renminbi in purchasing dollars. About 10 years earlier, he became less confident about his dollar assets. At that point, he exchanged his American currency for Canadian dollars to pay for his only son's school fees overseas. He also purchased a mansion in an old bourgeois neighborhood called Shaughnessy in Vancouver. With the remainder of his American funds, he bought into gold, petroleum, and other mineral and energy stocks with the intention of hanging on to them long term. Even more importantly, he decided to retain a good deal of renminbi and invest them in the Chinese real estate market. He didn't play the Chinese stock market because he couldn't spare the time, didn't like the duplicity and lack of transparency of the whole game, and didn't want to appear greedy. Over these past few years, his anti-American investment strategy had returned a hefty profit and confirmed him in his view of international economics. The 2008 financial tsunami caused him to reflect deeply on his economic theory, to reconstruct his mental image of the world economy and China's road to development, and cleverly to incorporate his further ideas into his action plan. He saw that the American-led developed countries, due to their two-party or even multi-party democratic political systems, had neither the ability nor the resolve to tame the monster known as globalized finance capitalism. America's elected politicians were beholden to a plethora of interest groups: Wall Street, big business, the arms industry, local power groups, the churches, the labor unions, and various public relations lobbies. They also had to take care of popular and media opinion. So when it was necessary for them to unite to accomplish something big and important, all they could do was look around to the left and right and fight meaningless little battles. They didn't dare to cut to the bone and heal the body politic, and were even less likely to take bold and decisive action. American market fundamentalists and the right wing of the Republican Party constantly dragged their feet and added to the confusion. They were completely out of touch with reality and could certainly mess things up, but they could not make any positive contributions. He Dongshen was completely discouraged by Western representative democracy. He didn't have the slightest hope for it. He was even less hopeful that those government financial decision makers, with their multifarious connections to Wall Street, had the cojones to make correct decisions that would save the world economy. On the contrary, he was more and more convinced that China's vast, post-totalitarian government really did have the ability to manage and direct this historical change of globalized finance capitalism. That is, if China had the correct understanding of the globalization of capital. He Dongshen realized, however, that in the Chinese system, merely having a correct understanding of any situation was not enough. This was because every level of the party state government was under the excessive control of interest groups and corrupt officials, and they would distort or reject even the most correct policy if it didn't profit them directly. Thus, He Dongshen thought that only a major, unprecedented crisis would permit the current ruling group to implement a genuine dictatorship, guarantee action at the bottom on every order from the top, and build a firm foundation for China's golden age of ascendancy that was just waiting to blossom out of the nation's growing power. He Dongshen had never imagined the 2008 global crisis would happen so soon. Nor had he imagined that on the first frenetic day, the Chinese Politburo would set in motion a completely new plan for tackling this situation. The policy proposal was called the Action Plan for Achieving Prosperity Amid Crisis. This proposal, of course, represented the collective wisdom of the entire Politburo Standing Committee, but very many of its elements were in accord with He Dongshen's own secret plan. First, let's answer the question, what about the United States? How did they start learning from our Chinese state-run system? The United States government printed money and sold bonds, tried to save the bankrupt car manufacturers, poured money into already defunct banks, spending all that money in the wrong places. The result was that credit didn't revive, the market continued to contract, house prices continued to plunge, the unemployment rate edged up as before, and the value of the US dollar steadily declined. American investors didn't want dollars, and international investors didn't want them either. Even the central banks of Japan, Russia, and Taiwan didn't dare to hold only American currency. American bonds, both long and short term, were hard to sell, no matter how good their interest rates were. The dollar rose for a while at the beginning of 2009, but a little later, it again lost 25 percentage points. In the end, worldwide confidence in the dollar reached a critical low, and in one trading day in February, panic selling began. This was followed by the collapse of the American stock market. The chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, the Secretary of the Treasury, and economics Nobel laureates such as Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman all agreed that the United States was in a state of high inflation decline or stagflation, what the Chinese media called an economic crisis of fire and ice. While the world economy was floundering, what was the situation in China? China was also in danger as exports came to a standstill. The number of unemployed suddenly rose steeply, and stock markets fell until trading was halted to forestall further losses. This time, China's economic growth would probably not avoid slipping from positive to negative figures. The economic stimulus of 2009, relying on the National Treasury to allocate funds for direct investments to stimulate the economy, helped maintain the national GDP, but it didn't genuinely encourage domestic consumer demand. Much of the stimulus money was invested in dubious megaprojects and fixed capital assets, and the chief beneficiaries were the bureaucrats, state-run enterprises, and the interest groups tied to their apron strings. In other words, the stimulus helped to increase the monopoly of state-run enterprises over the market and further decrease the scope of private businesses. The most troublesome thing was still the huge decline in the value of the dollar. Before 2004, China's annual trade surplus had not been very large. After 2004, however, China had less and less need to import foreign manufactured goods, and its exports grew at an ever more ferocious pace. China's foreign exchange reserves abruptly rose to over $2 trillion. Then all of a sudden, those dollars lost more than a third of their value. Although China had originally made a lot of noise about the dollar, it had not actually been selling off dollars the way Japan, Russia, and Taiwan had. China held on to its dollars and kept buying American dollar assets right up to the end. It wasn't that China didn't want progressively to distance itself from the dollar, but it lacked an alternative place to invest its money. The government was already trying to reach mutual currency exchange arrangements with Japan, South Korea, the ASEAN, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization nations, and was already actively urging the United States to issue some bonds payable in renminbi, what the foreign press had dubbed panda bonds. So it wasn't that the government wasn't making crisis preparations, it was that time was against them. They could only pray that the dollar would not decline further. They certainly could not imagine that it would go under so quickly. Politics is a cruel business. Just the crime of allowing our sovereign wealth to shrink so much was bad enough. Add to that the negative growth in the national economy that was certain to follow, and the ruling group at that time would have completely lost its prestige within the party. The following year, that governing group would not have had the strength to resist the opposition and would certainly have fallen from power. It would have been a time for their friends to weep and their enemies to laugh. And this is the most important reason why they resolutely decided to put the action plan for achieving prosperity amid crisis into operation. So, since they were going to die anyway, they thought they might as well make one last stand and take drastic measures to alter the course of the heavens and attempt to turn a bad situation into a victory. If they won, it would be a complete victory. And if they lost, well, if they lost, the great deluge that came after them would be a problem for the next party leadership to resolve. The day that the dollar fell so precipitously in 2011 was the eighth day of the first lunar month. The New Year vacation period had just ended, and except for a few factories, every place was open again for business. That morning, virtually all of the news media reported that the global economy had entered a period of fire and ice crisis. Where was the machinery of state? In fact, the public security police, the armed police and the army were all in a state of readiness that day. Party Central had announced to all levels of government that the entire nation was in a state of emergency and that the action plan for achieving prosperity amid crisis had gone into operation. This was a coordinated chain of actions. The entire nation had to be regarded as a single chessboard, and every move had to scrupulously follow the plan scheduled if complete success, total victory, was to be achieved. In the first phase, except for establishing martial law in Xinjiang and Tibet, the machinery of state was forbidden to do anything without express orders from Party Central. In other words, the party state machine was going to wait. Why? They were waiting to see how long it would take for genuine chaos to materialize. Waiting to see how long the common people could endure a state of anarchy. When they could take it no longer, the people themselves would call on the government not to abandon them. They would beg the government to save them. The machinery of state was waiting for the people of the entire nation once again to voluntarily and wholeheartedly give themselves into the care of the Leviathan. If large-scale rioting or a mass exodus of people occurred, that would be the signal for the machinery of state to go into action. As things turned out, the people went through 6 days of being so scared they couldn't face another such day. Rumors were circulating wildly, and by the seventh day, many regions reported to Party Central that a genuine upheaval had broken out in their area. Still, in this situation, only a few places experienced large-scale rioting and mass exodus. On the eighth day, the 15th of the first lunar month, token forces of the People's Liberation Army and the armed police entered over 600 cities around the country and, as expected, were welcomed with open arms by the local population. This demonstrated the fact that in a moderately well-off society, the people fear chaos more than they fear dictatorship. And besides, Chinese society was really not as disorderly as was imagined. The vast majority of the Chinese people crave stability. As long as the government was not a target of attack, everything could be easily taken care of. That afternoon, the National Security Police, the Armed Police, and the People's Liberation Army jointly announced the beginning of a crackdown on criminal elements, and social order was restored almost immediately. Even petty looting came to an abrupt halt. The government also announced that it would start distributing rice from its grain reserves. Rations would be handed out every day, completely free of charge, and no one would be refused. The people's livelihood would be guaranteed, and they need have no fear of hunger. The most interesting thing, however, was that the people grumbled that the reserve rice, having been harvested over a number of years, tasted bad. They didn't want to eat it, and they certainly weren't going to queue up for it. Also, due to the crackdown on criminal activity, the usual opportunists didn't dare to buy up the reserve grain to sell off to rice wine distilleries. Why? Why did you have to terrorize the common people like that? Fang Chaodi indignantly interrupted He Dongshen. He Dongshen answered as though he were delivering a classroom lecture. The beginning of the crisis was the key. If handled poorly at first, it would be hard to clean up the mess later. This crisis was extraordinarily serious enough to give rise to mass disturbances on a nationwide scale. It started as an economic crisis, but it was capable of causing the long, smouldering volcanic contradictions deep under the surface of society to erupt. If the government reaction was too mild and too fragmentary, the people would remain dissatisfied and their resentment would be even greater. If the government acted too harshly, dispensing strong medicine too hastily, some strata of society would not accept it and would fight back. No matter what the government did then, it would be the only target. The situation at the time was as follows. Except for incidents involving conflict between Han and minority ethnic nationalities, in general, most of the major protests involved a confrontation between the masses and the government. For years, many of the common people had long made up their minds and believed that the only way to solve their problems was to create a disturbance. The smallest thing, the pettiest grievance, was enough to set off a collective protest. If mass protest riots broke out at the same time all over the country and all the criticism and resentment was aimed at the government, the machine of state would have collapsed. On the other hand, as long as all the complaints were not aimed at the government, mass protests would be difficult to start. A few lawless elements stirring up trouble would be insufficient to start a series of mass protests. So what did the leadership do to prevent the popular masses from aiming all of their resentment and criticism at the government? Asked Fang Chaodi. Well, after considering the situation from every angle,
Her leadership decided that the only way to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat was to allow the Chinese people to frighten themselves. Let them be afraid of the government abandoning them, afraid of anarchy. The condition of anarchy is what Thomas Hobbes called the war of all against all. In an anarchic state of nature, to quote his book, The Leviathan, the life of man is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. To have no security for their life and property is, indeed, the people's ultimate terror. And because they're afraid of anarchy and chaos, everyone is willing to bow down voluntarily before the power of a really quite unlovely Leviathan. Only this Leviathan of a government can guarantee their lives and property. That means the